I was born on the prairie in the milk of its wheat. The red of its clover, the eyes of its women, gave me a song and a slogan. Here the water went down, the iceberg slid with gravel, the gaps and the valleys hissed, and the black loam came, and yellow sandy loam. Here, between the sheds of the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians, here now a morning star fixes a fire sign over the timber claims and cow pastures, the corn belt, the cotton belt, the cattle ranches. Here the gray geese go 500 miles and back with the wind under their wings, honking the cry for a new home. Here I know I will hanker after nothing so much as one more sunrise or a sky moon of fire doubled by a river moon of water. The prairie sings to me in the forenoon, and I know in the night I rest easy in the prairie arms on the prairie heart.
Good morning. I'm Steve Hummel. My father was a professor in the English department here at K-State for 22 years until his death in 1972. And my mother raised myself and four sisters, younger sisters, and Karen, who's a docent at the Beach Museum, presented us with an opportunity to make a donation to develop a meadow area by the Beach Museum of native plants, and it's coming together very nicely. It's pretty impressive. Nice place to sit and meditate. Karen's written a few words about why we think this was a good thing to do for our family, and she'd like to go ahead and present that.
Why is the meadow a fitting memorial to Bill and Sally Hummel? Bill and Sally grew up in a close-knit neighborhood in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Families formed close friendships, and it seemed like a continuous block party. We know that because Sally's mom kept a diary. Fast forward to the 1950s at K-State. Bill was one of the bright young professors James McCain brought to campus. Bill and Sally had married and started a family. The English department was a close-knit group, and the parties continued. Bill and Sally had five children who produced 16 grandchildren, resulting so far in more than 20 great-grandchildren, and we're counting. It's a close-knit family with deep roots. Diversity abounds, and the joy continues. Prairie roots grow deep. Prairie seeds disperse with the aid of pollinators and wind. Succession of species and perpetuation of the prairie depends upon cherishing and celebrating native species and giving them an environment to thrive. The meadow celebrates native prairie. The joy we feel there perpetuates the memory and legacy of Bill and Sally.
Shining.
Now is that moment in our Sunday, every Sunday, when we ask that each of you share joys and concerns so that we can share those with you. And I'm going to start out by sharing a concern. I've had an extremely humbling morning, which involved locking my laptop and the presentation in my car at about 10 o'clock out here. And so we're getting off to a little bit of a late start, and I thank you all for bearing with me. I think I saw a hand go up back here.
I'm Jane Pelletier. I have a guest with me this morning, Linda Schmidt. Linda, you want to stand up and say hi? So, please make her feel welcome.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I met Christopher Breitweiser as I was coming up the stairs from the parking lot. Christopher's traveling across the country. This is the first Unitarian fellowship he's been to. He's been going to numerous churches across the country. Says that he thinks every denomination has a piece of the truth, and he wanted to come here. And he went up to North Dakota and hopes to make it back to Daytona Beach on his bike with his dog, Debo, who's in the parking lot, by before the snow.
I wanted to share a joy. We have a guest with us today. This is Nina. She'll be joining with us with the RE program today.
My name's Brina, and I'm happy to say that I got a small part-time job at the greenhouse at the VA. And two, I'm starting singing lessons starting tomorrow at 4:30, so I can improve my voice a bit. So, yeah.
Shirley Hobrock, membership chair. And I'd like to introduce three new members that just signed the book. Sarah Lott, would you stand up, Sarah? And Alex Stinson. And Heather Mugo.
Hi, I'm Michaela Sievers, and my joy this morning is seeing all of the wonderful Halloween costumes.
Hi, Larry Weaver. My joy actually has to do with what's already happened in the program, that song. I haven't sung it in a long, long time, but that it just made me think of times that I've been in a canoe looking up at a rock wall, and a flower is growing out of the rock. I mean, the tenacity, the strength, the persistence of life. I mean, life, that great and fiery force, that I am life at the end of that line, that's amazing to me.
Well, I guess since Riley is not going to say it, today is his fifth birthday.
Thank you.
I want to be a paleontologist when I'm a grown up.
Thank you.
I have a joy that my brother got his first tattoo.
I think that was amended to fake tattoo.
I have a joy my mom is feeling better.
We will certainly carry with us the joys and concerns today, both those that were spoken and those that were unspoken that we know are present and with us as well.
For the first time, a new song to send the children out. It's called the Reeb Children's Benediction, named for James Reed. Went to Selma, Alabama in 1965, and was killed there as a demonstrator. He was a Unitarian minister. The man who wrote this, not the words but the tune, was the music director at the James Reeb Memorial Congregation in Wisconsin. I'm sorry to tell you that he, after 15 years as a music director in Unitarian Universalist churches, he looked at what went on over there and said, heck, I could do that and get a pay raise maybe. And he is now a UU minister in Las Vegas, Nevada, where his services are desperately needed. So what we're going to do is we're going to, do you have the music in there? We're going to start singing it, and we're going to sing it, and we're going to sing it, and we're going to sing it. And then when the children, after the children's song, we're all going to sing it together. But we can start right now, okay?
And this is working. So, kids, anybody want to come up for children's conversation / story for all ages? Oh, my. Oh, look. Princess, excuse me, witch, bat, girl, what? A rogue? Ooh, ooh, ooh. Piper, what are you, a ninja? Man, oh, man. This is so cool. So today the adults, you guys got to leave me a space. Today the adults have, hi, Lice. Today the adults are going to talk about something called meadow thinking. Did you listen to the hymn and listen to what Larry said about how cool that fiery life and getting to see flowers growing out of rocks and stuff like that? When I was a little girl, the house I grew up in was, the backyard was connected to a big open field. Beautiful flowers, wildflowers, all kinds of stuff like that. So the house I grew up in was a lot of fun because I could go out into the yard behind our house and lay down on the grass. And on the floor? Oh, okay. I could lay down in the grass in the meadow and just listen. Can you guys lay down and listen too? And please? And the grasses in California weren't as great as the grasses in Kansas. But if the grasses moved, what would they sound like? We need grasses sound. Do you feel them? Do you hear them? What does that make you think of? What could you lay down and think about if you're laying down in a meadow? Oh, my goodness. I could think about stepping on a child's head. I'm so sorry. What would you think about? Rose, what would you think about? Rain. Oh, you could lay there and might it rain on you? What would you think about? The grass is blowing. What if there was a butterfly coming past? Yes?
About the sun.
You'd think about the sun, and it shines down on you and warms your body as you're laying there, part of the meadow.
And you think about the grass tickling you.
The grass tickling you and touching you and making you feel tingly and part of the earth.
on your nose.
A butterfly could be on your nose and tickle you, and you could feel maybe like you were flying like a butterfly. What do you think about that? Yeah. So there's a story here that I found at the library about a little girl who follows a butterfly. It's called In the Meadow. She follows a butterfly. She's with her family, and she follows a butterfly into the meadow. And as she walks in, she says, "Oh, the grass holds my sandals." As she's walking into the meadow, she can't quite reach the butterfly because see how the grass is grabbing on her sandals? Long leaves, round leaves, jagged leaves tickle my legs. Tickle, tickle, tickle. The wind blows rustling leaves. The meadow sways like the waves of the sea. My tummy sinks into the wave. My shoulders sink too. Can you feel grasses grabbing around you? Only my hat and my face are above the green sea. Oh, those are some great grasses. I'm surrounded by tall plants. Their leaves look down at me silently. I can no longer see the butterfly. Boing, a grasshopper jumps on my arm. "Hello, grasshopper. Please don't go away." Boing. Uh-oh. Grasshopper went away.
Hi.
Are there grasshoppers here in Kansas? Lots and lots. A leaf hits my cheek. When I move, I want to cry, so I close my eyes. Now she's in the grass with her eyes closed. What does she hear as she closes her eyes? Got good grass here. Suddenly, I hear many different sounds all together. Swish, swish, scrunch, scrunch, scrunch. Tweet, tweet, chirp, chirp. And the faraway river is singing. Swish, 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 swish. Where am I? She wonders. The girl's name is Yu Chen. Yu Chen, what are you doing? I open my eyes, and there's my mom smiling at me. Mom, how did you know where I was? She was so absorbed in the grass, in the meadow, listening to the sounds, the birds, and the river. That's pretty good. That she forgot where she was, and she didn't think anybody else knew where she was. So what I want you guys to do as we go out is to think about quiet moments where you can lay down, close your eyes, and listen to the sounds, and imagine new and big things. Ready?
So we're having a few AV difficulties, and I'll just start. I'm going to launch right in here as this person who's become my most valued companion today works on it. The meditative words that we open today's service with are from Carl Sandburg's 1918 poem, Prairie. which reflects likely on the prairies of his youth in Illinois, where the glaciers did shape land, unlike here, where glaciation never reached. According to Theodore Roosevelt, we've taken into our language the word prairie because when our backwoodsmen first reached the land in the Midwest and saw the great natural meadows of long grass, sites unknown to the gloomy forests wherein they had always dwelt, they knew not what to call them and borrowed the term already in use among the French inhabitants. Prairie is the French word for meadow. Prairies are ecosystems considered part of the temperate grassland savannas and shrubland biome by ecologists, based on similar temperate climates, moderate rainfall, and a composition of grasses, herbs, and shrubs, rather than trees, as the dominant vegetation type. Temperate grassland regions include the pampas of Argentina, the cerrado of Brazil, and Uruguay, as well as the steppes of Eurasia. Lands typically referred to as prairie proper tend to be in North America. The term encompasses the area referred to as the interior lowlands of the United States, areas of Canada, and Mexico. Let's circle a little closer. What is a meadow? A meadow can be wild or landscaped, uncultivated or cultivated, to encourage a particular combination of grass and wildflower species. The title of this talk and this presentation and service today is Meadow Thinking, because the prairie tempts me to think in gestalt terms, to observe the minute details of each plant species, while simultaneously embracing a grassland's unified fabric of color and texture that gives a total sense of place. I offer you these words from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources on that sense of place from the prairie. Imagine a kaleidoscope of color that shifts with the seasons, the smoky haze of pasque flowers in spring, the purple of blazing star and deep orange of butterfly weed in hot midsummer, the red gold of raspy grasses in fall, the white sparkle of frost on straw-colored grasses in the winter. This is the prairie palette that marked the seasons for native peoples of long ago, when vast grasslands spread from the northwestern to the southeastern tips of the state. These grasslands range from sparsely vegetated sand dunes to the vast fields of big bluestem up to 8 feet tall, from low, wet sedge meadows to short grass prairies high on the bluffs of the Mississippi River. Bison and elk roam the plains, and prairie birds such as the upland sandpiper and sandhill crane were plentiful. With the advent of European settlement, much of the flat and fertile prairie land fell to the settlers' plow. Now, just a century and a half later, only 1%, about 150,000 acres, of the original 18 million acres of prairie remains. Urban sprawl, agricultural expansion, and gravel mining continue to threaten this rich resource. As natural prairie habitats dwindle, so too do the species of prairie mammals, birds, and insects. Protection is critical if this complex ecosystem, or rather really a collection of complex ecosystems with its shifting array of color and form, is to survive into the future. Small virgin prairies exist in the American Midwestern states and in Canada. As most of you probably know, the Flint Hills region encompasses over 1.6 million hectares, extending throughout much of eastern Kansas from near the Nebraska border into northeastern Oklahoma, and contains the largest remaining area of unplowed tallgrass prairie in North America. Could I ask for an assistant who might help me to click? Thank you very much. Each spring, thousands of acres of tallgrass prairie are burned to clear the mulch that inhibits the growth of tall grasses. Interestingly, prairies pull more carbon from the ecosystem each year than they release, even if they're burned annually. Prairie plants take carbon from their environment and store it beneath the ground as soil organic carbon. We've known for a long time that prairies build organic soils. That's why grasslands make such good farmland. But recently, that ability has gotten more notice because of its contribution to carbon sequestration efforts. That's from Chris Helzer, ecologist and program director for the Nature Conservancy in Nebraska. Thank you. And so we see an ever-increasing number of planted meadow landscapes, created for aesthetics and to reduce the use of pesticides, herbicides, and the amount of fuel used to mow conventional landscapes of turf grass, and eventually, with the growth of their rich and complex root systems, to assist in sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. Here is another potential meaning for meadow thinking. As the UUFM congregation moves forward from our recent visioning exercises, we seek to be a brighter, bolder beacon to our community. We seek to share our values of justice, democratic participation, interconnectedness, compassion, and free thinking. The Meadow Project is an example of another community, the Art Museum, academic units at K-State, and our many partners, creating a beacon, an outward presence to represent many diverse values. I wonder if this example, which we'll be talking about shortly, can help open up a discussion of the ways in which we at UUFM might be a beacon, into what form our beacon may manifest. Okay, and now I'm going to go through some slides a little more quickly, so I'll ask you to help me. We can go on into the next one. You might be wondering just what is this meadow, and I'm going to see if I can adjust so that I can see the slide and speak with you. The meadow is a learning landscape of native plants. It's adjacent to the Beach Museum at Kansas State University. So if you know where the archway is at the museum, it's just through that archway. It was created for many reasons, and the main reasons are to be a demonstration of sustainable landscaping, a natural laboratory for a variety of learning activities, a resource for teaching, a plant identification and native plants establishment, an experiential component for Beach Museum tours, allowing visitors to examine, touch, and smell some of the same plants that are represented in the art collection there, and an extension of the work of beach educators and faculty across campus to make meaningful connections between landscape art and science. This is an image of how it looks today, or about a month ago, actually. Thank you. And the meadow is also a living memorial. As you heard from Karen and Steve Hummel, this is a living memorial established in memory of Professor William C. Hummel and Sarah T. Hummel. We have a variety of partners that you can see here. And if we go into the next slide, this starts to show you some of the relationships and partnerships that came together in order to manifest this kind of landscape. Go to the next one. It's not really important how things started. What you see there at the far left is myself and the director of the museum, Linda Duke, a conversation that began. What's more important are all these dots up here. Each represents a different unit at K-State, and the purple ones represent different community partners as well. You can go on, thanks. Great. So we began with a site right outside the museum, as I mentioned, really an underused place. This was just some poorly tended turf grass. The one thing this site really had going for it, though, besides location, which is amazing, right at the cusp of the campus community and the town community, it also had several mature trees, has several beautiful mature trees. This area was once part of the Arboretum on campus. So we began to think and envision what kind of landscape we might want in this space and how we would want people to be able to interact with that landscape. And that led to the idea of a meadow versus strictly a prairie establishment, because we have a lot of different sun and shade conditions on the site. I mentioned that a really key goal for this place is to make connections to the regional collection at the Beach Museum, which I imagine almost everyone here is very familiar with. This is just a few selections from their works, and you can see the representation of prairie within the building, and now we have some prairie representation outside the building. We're hoping this landscape will also allow us to bring the work of STEM researchers at K-State in front of the public in a much more accessible way. One of our goals is to have a series of outreach workshops so that we can help coach these researchers to use visual thinking and learning methods to talk about their work versus the egg-headed ways that, no offense to anyone who's a scientist in the crowd, that scientists often talk about their work with lay people. In fact, this is just an illustration of that model, and I won't talk about it too much in detail. We have a couple of grant proposals pending to help us fund that model. So a lot of planning went into actually being able to put anything in the ground to manifest this beacon. We began back in 2012 with simply conversations, gathering a team. A lot of key people were brought into the project at that point, including Rhonda Yonke. I think I saw Harriet here earlier. Is Harriet here? Great. And Rhonda had planned to be here, but then had some other things come up this weekend. Also, some folks who do research at the CONSA in the ecophysiology lab joined our team at that point. Here's the plan of the meadow. And you can see that it, besides the planted areas, it also includes paths for people to move within the landscape, a place for gathering and seating. And I think, unfortunately, it's a little bit small for you to read, but what those different color-coded areas show is where different mixes of plant communities were seated for different light and shade conditions. So this is a community-built project. And what that means is it depends upon the generosity and hard work of a lot of different people. It began with a Boy Scout project. The Boy Scouts actually hand-sewed those erosion control socks that you see. Well, they used machines, so I guess technically it's not hand-sewed. But they sewed these things out of old T-shirts, recycled material, filled them with mulch, and then tied each end off with a zip tie. And their efforts, which took them, I think, about 3 weekends of work in sewing, and then many of us a long weekend of installation, it saved the project about $1,500. So that one connection made a really valuable contribution for us. What you see here is the very first volunteer day to begin to seed the site. We had a terrific group of people out working with us. And then things began to grow. And I will talk less, and we'll just look at some images through here. I'll just jump in, if you don't mind, just slowly clicking through them. Here's where I'll jump in. We did have to remove 2 aging hackberry trees from the site, not to accommodate our plans, but actually because the trees were so broken out and old, they were a hazard and could have quite easily come down in a storm on the building or on pedestrians. So even as the site, the vegetation was growing in, these pieces of hackberry were being repurposed and reused. We didn't throw anything away. Some of this wood went to Rhonda Yonke's student farm in order to become a substrate for growing shiitake mushrooms. Some of it, the sawdust, actually was the medium that we used to scatter our seeds. And these really nice large logs became benches, and you'll see a few images of that. Hackberry has a beautiful grain. You can see the end of it there on this bench. And you can see the benches finally being used by people. So the place is growing, and with that comes some really beautiful wildflowers and grasses and a whole lot of weeds. You can see both here. Oh, and more signs of use. I got really excited the first day I found a coffee cup ring on the benches. And so now our call to volunteers and my own work in the meadow and others, it really isn't glamorous at all. It's tending to controlling those weeds for the first couple of years while the native plants become established. They're putting down growth underground, and so their growth above ground tends to be less showy, with the exception of the coreopsis you see here. It's an annual, so it just puts out all of its energy above ground. But most of the other prairie plants are really getting set up below ground and might only have 6 inches to a foot of growth this year. We take all volunteers, even the very young. And the rewards are already beginning to show as we see different wildflowers becoming established here. And as the site becomes a bit more grown in and looks more intentional, we see that a lot more people are using it spontaneously to meet and be there, or to teach and host events, or just to quietly read. This is someone I saw reading, and I snuck up, and I did ask first if I could take a photo. Thank you. And if you'd like to find out more about the meadow, you can visit our blog to learn more information. My guests, the Hummel family, and I, we welcome your comments on the meadow or your thoughts on how the UUFM may be a beacon to the broader community.
I just have one quick question. Is coreopsis a natural wildflower here?
Yes, it is. That's the plains coreopsis, coreopsis tinctorum, it is. But it's an annual and purposely was part of our mix to give us a little bit of wow in that first kind of ugly year of growth. I honestly think it sort of saved our project in the eyes of the average campus pedestrian.
I had a question. Did you have to do something to the soil before you planted, or did you just work with it as is?
That's a great question. We did not do a darn thing to the soil. And there are actually many different reasons to do or not to do something to the soil, but one misconception that I could help with right now, when you're doing an establishment in native plants, it's quite different than growing a garden or growing ornamental plants that most of us are used to. So whereas those things we go and buy at Westside, Eastside Market, they need nice, fluffy, loam, nitrogen-rich soil, that's not necessary for establishing native plants. Actually, many of them are adapted to conditions of hard, clayey, rocky soil, and having less nitrogen actually helps to encourage the natives to become established because it discourages those weeds, which love to have lots of available nitrogen in the soil. So it goes a bit counterintuitive to things you might consider when you're starting a garden, per se.
How difficult would it be to actually do this on a residential level? Say like you have a section of your yard or your entire yard turned to prairie.
I'm going to invite Karen to help me answer that because I think she has some experience. I'll just say quickly, that depends on how much of a purist you are. I used to be a real purist when it comes to landscape establishment, and now I am so not. I'm so zen about weeds, and, you know, a meadow can be as simple as stopping mowing your lawn, right? It could be that simple. It could be that you selectively add plants you like, or you could eradicate what's there and then plant. There's always going to be a little back and forth with those weeds, but if you take a zen attitude toward it, that's my two cents.
And it's owing to what you call a weed. When we moved to the house we have now, we had a small grove of fir trees. We trimmed those up so to expose the ground beneath. Pitcher sage came up. Pitcher sage might be regarded as a weed by some people. I love it. We left it. And we have other things that are coming up, for instance, some milkweed. And my philosophy is that I'll live with things that walk in for a year or two, and if they don't take over, they're welcome to stay. If they don't.
I should say that Karen has planted a number of native plant varieties. As she mentioned, we did have some volunteers move in. We live on the west side of town up by the water tank, and that was all open prairie for effect. and a lot of volunteer plants moved into that section once we kind of cleared up the evergreen trees.
Hi, that was really nice. Do you have to do any scheduled burnings like they do out at Kanza?
Well, don't we wish we could right there in the middle of campus next to all those expensive buildings and things. We as a team, we decided pretty early on not to try to push that issue with campus administration for a couple reasons. Actually, there is a really beautiful mature cedar tree at one corner of the site, and if a fire did get out of control, that thing would be a real hazard to a lot of areas around it. And so what we're doing is what's very common in a lot of cultivated meadows. We will have a mowing schedule that helps to remove that thatch. It's not the same as burning. If you know about burning in the prairie, there's a lot of things that occur, a lot of things that are triggered through that process. But it does help to approximate that. And so, in fact, we'll do our first kind of close mow all the way down here in about a month. And then annually or biannually, we will be having more mows out there.
Wait, Abigail. If you were inclined to naturalize your yard, but know zip zero about native versus whatever, is there some place to shop here in town that could guide you as to what kinds of, I mean, where did you get your plants? And
I'm happy to share with you. Actually, I'll make sure you have our blog website, because it has a list of the names of sources of seed that we've used. I wish I could tell you that there's a great native plants nursery right here. There's not. I think the closest thing we have to that is the Lee Creek Nursery, where they do provide a few different cultivars of native plants. You can find really nice goldenrods and, can you hear me? Oh, Lee Creek Gardens. It's down in the Ashland Bottoms area. So it's actually, if you go down McDowell Creek Road, don't turn like you're going to the cons that go into Ashland. So they have a few things you can certainly buy. But in terms of getting seeds, we have to reach a little bit further out. Sharp Seed in Healy, Kansas is a great native supplier. We've got the Kaw River Restoration Nursery, which can provide seed or plugged small plants. That's in Baldwin City near Lawrence, Kansas. There's a tremendous amount of resources online as well if you want to order seeds, for example.
Okay. Actually saw Dick's hand first.
We're relatively new to Kansas, and we're very impressed with what we assumed were native plants around the Discovery Center. And I was just wondering if you could make any comparison.
Sure. I think there's a lot of really beautiful landscaping done there. I think I could make a comparison in terms of the way it's installed and the way it'll be maintained. That landscape required, well, it was more costly per square foot, let's put it that way, because it was installed from live plants. Everything there was live plants versus being seeded. So it's a fairly resource-intensive way to make that kind of landscape. And then around those live plants, they mulched, and that requires that hand weeding be done throughout the first several years, and actually probably for a very long time. So it's also a more intensive way to establish native plants in terms of maintenance. But it is a very quick, showy way, because you get that great growth and flowers. Yeah. I think it's beautiful. I'm so happy to see those kind of things become part of our public landscapes in Manhattan.
I just want to thank Katie for what she has done at Meadowlark, that she helped establish wildflower area just south of the main building and some other places. And then we've continued seeding wildflowers, and not I, but some of the others just planted 1,000 wetland plants around that pond. They mucked them in and lowered the pond level and planted them, and then they will raise the pond level. And also planted, there's a meadow that I didn't even know existed that's, you can't see, you have to walk over anyway.
I think that's your neighbor's work, Sue Hunt, that right?
Sue Hunt, yeah.
And Sue is terrific. We've met around the Buyer Pond Committee at Meadowlark, And Sue was a volunteer, helped us plant the meadow here too. So through Sue, I'm hoping that we can have a longer-term sort of engagement between your meadow at Meadowlark, the V Meadow, I think they call it, up north. Yeah. That's the one you have to walk to. You don't see it. It would be wonderful if we could have a relationship where we're maybe sharing seeds, even sharing calls for volunteers, perhaps sharing informative speakers or different kinds of events. I hope that's something that we can really forge.
I do not have a green thumb, I have to say, but I would love to have something like that in my yard, front and back. What difficulties would I encounter with the city of Manhattan if I would just start letting things grow?
Okay. I assume you live in town.
Yes.
Yes. You would encounter difficulties if you start letting things grow. I'll tell you a story from Johnson County, where the move toward more native landscaping maybe has a 10-year edge on us here in Manhattan. A community member decided to allow his lawn to grow and also to selectively remove the really noxious weeds and begin to put in native plants. So he was harassed by the code officers. And what he did in response is take a can of that landscape spray paint, and he went over to his neighbor's yard that was mowed turf grass, and he circled every noxious weed, dandelion, thistle coming up, circled all of those, and then did the same thing in his meadow-like yard, and it was much fewer. Then he invited the code officer to come back and take a look. Because really, it's the issue that we have with unmown lots or yards is around proliferating noxious weeds that we don't want for agricultural reasons. So I'm kind of telling you that story. I thought it was hilarious, actually, this person. I'm sure his neighbor didn't appreciate it, but, you know, I think it would be something to really consider and think about, and we can talk more, Elka, outside of, if you want to. One strategy that most people use when they're trying to do an establishment like the one we showed is to have some kind of a groomed edge around it, right? So what we've done, much of the site will have a buffalo grass edge that will be mown, and that helps to signal to people this is intentional. It's not just that I quit mowing my lawn or, you know, or I moved out and didn't tell anyone, something like that.
Oh, that was a really beautiful presentation. Thanks. And thank you, Hummels. That's a wonderful idea and memorial to your parents. What can we do here on our beautiful grounds? That, I mean, and we always have a sort of a labor issue about getting people to come out and help. What could we establish here? And also, what could you do? Does a meadow require sun? A lot of sun? What are the light requirements?
That's one of the reasons I think that initiated taking out those big hackberries is so that they could open up to more light.
They were going to, they had to come down. I guess that's the way to say it. And we certainly wouldn't want to be seen as tree killers. That's why I'm very careful about saying that. But we weren't sad that it opened up a little more sun.
Okay.
Steve, sorry, I didn't mean to interject there. Let me just say quickly in response, coming back to the idea of how picky you are about what a meadow is. What if we decided to stop mowing an area of our field and instead to just mow paths through that children could play on? That's a fairly low maintenance concept. I am very sensitive to the question that Sylvia has asked, because every type of landscape project I work on with a community, maintenance is a huge issue. It takes people power, right? And so I believe in planning carefully for what you can feasibly maintain. And if it's outside of your reach, then let's not build in that way. To be very honest, right now at the meadow, we're kind of in dire need of a volunteer day to weed back some things on our edges. And as Karen is aware, we want to do some more seeding as well. There's a few areas that should be really high profile that just don't look so great at this point. So we'll be seeding a little bit more. We'll also be doing some plugging in the springtime of really showy plants. Do you want to add anything, Karen, about how you see maintenance or volunteers, how that process has been? If you have anything you want to add.
Well,
I think you have to.
I will volunteer to help.
See, this is the best kind of partner right here.
I have a question, and I may have missed this earlier. Are the plants labeled or identified at the meadow?
They are not yet. What we are planning to do is some very carefully designed interpretive signage. It probably won't be like what you see at a botanical garden, where there's a sign every foot or so. Do you know what I mean? Because part of our goal is to let people really perceive the landscape as a fabric. And I think when you stop and have a didactic moment every 3 feet, that doesn't really happen. But we do want to provide more opportunities for interpretation. So there'll be some type of signage that'll go up, I think, within about 8 months. And then also our blog has a lot of detailed information about plants. And eventually we hope to have an interactive display inside the museum, something like a touch table, where if any of you have seen those at museums, where you could maybe click on a big plant of the meadow and go right to different species and learn about them or learn other things about prairie ecosystems.
Can you talk about anything about wildlife? Like, were there any plans dealing with wildlife? Were there any issues with already existing campus wildlife?
Oh, boy, you speak as though you know about our squirrel problem. We have this squirrel, and I am an animal lover. I want to say that first. I really am. But I wouldn't mind if some nice person with a BB gun. I didn't say that. I totally didn't say that. But what we have happening is K-State has so many squirrels. There's an overpopulation of squirrels, and there's a scarcity of food. And so what's happened, not as a result of our project, it was actually going on before our project, there's a squirrel that is eating the bark off of the lacebark elms on the site. There's three of these beautiful elm trees. Even before we began our project, one of them had to be almost entirely cut halfway out because the squirrel had girded the branches. And it's looking like we're going to lose at least two of those trees. You can see this little guy just up there busy eating that bark. It's pretty frustrating. And I guess that shows you in a suburban and urban type of situation where things can really become out of balance. Of course, it would be very unpopular if we proposed controlling squirrel population at K-State. And yet there's too many of them, and they don't have enough food. I didn't answer entirely. Your question had to do with other issues of wildlife. And I will just say, oh, and we're going to run out of time. Michael tells me to cut it off. I'll talk more with you later about it. I want to be sure to thank Steve and Karen. Thank you so much for coming and speaking about this. Yes. Yes, and the entire Hummel family.
The closing hymn is number 49, Stillness Reigns. Please stand as you are able.
I was born on the prairie in the milk of its wheat, the red of its clover. The eyes of its women gave me a song and a slogan. The prairie sings to me in the forenoon, And I know in the night I will rest easy in the prairie arms, on the prairie heart. Thank you.